Welcome to Put Simply, the podcast that puts what's happening in the world simply without compromising on the details. Adam Koch is my name. Ozani Brishim and Rodney McCune are my co-hosts. Gents, good to see you again.
Good to see you too.
Great to be with you both.
Well, this week is a monumental one in terms of anniversaries and commemorative events. October 7, 2023 was, of course, the day that really sparked what we've seen over the last 12 months or so. It was the day that Hamas terrorists entered into Israel, killing around 1,200 people, mostly Israeli civilians, at a music festival that then, of course, sparked a brutal assault on Gaza that has left tens of thousands of people dead, a lot of them Palestinian civilians, that then, of course, resulted in the last month of things that we've seen, including a land invasion in Lebanon, the bombing of Beirut, Iran's response just hours after last week's podcast, and a tense, tense Middle East. Let's go back to starting on sort of October 7 and the images that we saw of what Hamas did. And let's take it from there. Ozan, it felt on the day that we were on the edge of something monumental. Could we have thought that 1 year on would still be, I guess, feeling the ramifications of what happened on that day?
I mean, I guess you have to go back to what you were feeling on that day. I won't talk for both of you, but I felt horror. I felt disgust at what I had seen and just hopelessness. I have to say most of those feelings still exist 12 months later for different reasons. I think what we've seen can only be described as an awful, awful 12 months in the region, impacting on the thousands, tens of thousands, if not millions of Gazans in that area, but also Israelis. And I think we're no closer to a solution. In fact, it really questions the faith in humanity. I think what we saw on October 7, Israel's response 12 months down the track, we really should be in a very different place. And I think many people today are asking the question, where does this end? And we know that the only solution is something that we've all been saying for a long time is a two-state solution. But I don't think we could be further away from that today. And that is very depressing. I don't see where there is an open door for any political off-ramp or political kind of solution that can be discussed. It's taken on a completely new level and a whole new kind of paradigm with Iran and Hezbollah actively now involved in the conflict. And yeah, it was a somber day 12 years ago, a horrific day, and it's a somber day today when we look back on how little has been achieved and how incredible amount of human life has been lost and how much kind of further we are away from a political solution.
Well, I guess in terms of what wanted to be achieved by the Israeli Defense Force, by Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel, was effectively the eradication of Hamas, right? That was the point, that Hamas would pay for what they did on October 7, 2023. It feels like, Rodney, it's now taken a much more, I guess, complex, convoluted and regional dynamic. Is that a view that you would subscribe to?
Yes, it clearly has taken on a regional dynamic. And, you know, when we look back to what the trigger day was, because obviously there's different narratives of what led up to the 7th of October last year with competing narratives. But, you know, what we had was a very shocking but not surprising attack on Israeli civilians by Hamas. And, of course, there's still disputes within different narratives as to exactly what went on that day. But, you know, there's a fairly solid evidence base to say it was one of the most shocking attacks on a civilian population that, you know, one could see or one could witness. The regional dynamic has flowed from what I I see as Israel taking the view that if it's going to go on the offensive against what it perceives to be its enemies or regional opponents, that it may as well do it on a wider scale than limit themselves narrowly. I mean, if you look at sentiment a year ago, Israel could not have been better placed on the moral high ground. It could not have had a greater degree of international sympathy. And Israel having the right to defend itself were words that rolled off the tongue of spokespersons across the globe. But when you say someone has the right to defend themselves, you have to then say, well, what does that actually entail? What are the boundaries around that? What is the military and political objectives that Israel has? And those are things which have become less and less clear over the period of the last 12 months, to the point where we just see now that they're going on an offensive again with Hezbollah. There's now the military interaction with Iran, and there's an anticipation that there's going to be a larger Israeli response potentially against nuclear facilities. And this is not what anyone saw coming, really, when the events of a year ago took place. And in fact, the conversation around the hostages even feels like it's sort of fallen off the pecking order in terms of where the global or international conversation about the events in the Middle East actually are. The discussions now about what next with Iran, what next on the northern border in southern Lebanon, and very little in relation to Hamas, which again, others will know better who are on the ground and those who are in a active within the intelligence and military circles. But we don't really know what the state or the capacity of Hamas is, how much Israel has or hasn't degraded that capacity. Whether the objective that it set itself of destroying Hamas is close or not, in terms of what they said they were going to do 1 year ago. But yeah, we're in a very regional point of conflict. There's a very much a regional dynamic around this all now, and it doesn't feel as if it's something which is de-escalating or shrinking in any way. It feels like something which is going to get worse before it gets better, sadly.
It feels like it's one of those things that, so many politicians will have a direct, simple message around it. To your point, Rodney, that Israel has a right to defend itself, and therefore, sort of everything is possible and everything is in many ways justified. Then, of course, the other side of the equation, well, actually, the bombings of schools and mosques and churches, and basic places where children gather and women gather. And Oxfam, I think, released a report that the number of women and children killed in Gaza sort of outweighs any other conflict, at least in modern times, in terms of the severity of what's happened. There's the element of, well, where is this going? But even from just a political perspective and a support perspective, we saw over the weekend tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands of people gather in many Western countries, in the capital cities, in the major cities, to protest what is happening and have that sort of pro-Palestinian view of what's happening in the world. Ozan, the complexity of it, I think, is enormous and definitely not something that we can do justice and any sort of one show can do justice. But it feels like so much of what is happening in the world is being replicated here, where the extreme voices on both ends take charge, and there isn't that discussion in the sensible center of what needs to be done.
I mean, growing up, we would have all heard about very difficult problems being referred to as very much analogous to the Middle East conflict. And if you were trying to achieve something that was difficult, it was trying to bring peace to the Middle East, etc. That has now become even more difficult, and I'm not even sure possible, to be honest with you, in our lifetimes. I think it is very complicated. It has always been very complicated. We went through periods of some hope, I think, and again, it comes down to a two-state solution, and we had a number of foreign leaders showed great support to such a solution, political support. But I would have to say that or most hope has been lost over the last 15, 20 years, certainly since Hamas, after a brief civil war in Gaza, took control. I think most, and also Netanyahu and Likud Party and the Israeli side getting more and more political power from the point of view of the kind of fundamentalist wing of the Israeli government, and the settlers becoming more and more powerful and expanding their kind of activities. I think all most hope had been lost, and October 7 kind of, as Rodney rightly pointed out, wasn't a surprise, but still was horrific and shocking and underscored the complexity of where things were at. Yes, Israel had every bit of the moral high ground, but within a week or two, pretty much lost it all. And I don't think they've regained it. And I don't think they will regain it. I think they've really been in a position where, we are not generals. We are not on the ground. We don't know exactly what type of military operation and objectives they're trying to reach. But I think at the end of the day, most people are of the view of your military objectives don't cannot justify the death and destruction that they've inflicted in Gaza. And I think most of the world community is behind that type of argument and that type of sentiment. So at some point, Israel has to say, okay, well, we have to start opening the door to a political solution. And whilst it's become extremely complex, and as you said, there's no way we can unpack all of these different elements of this whole conflict in one show, it really requires, at this point in time, Israel to open the door to some sort of political solution for the long term. And it's going to take a very, very long time to achieve that type of political solution. But the only way out of this is diplomacy and politics, because any more war destruction, we've had 60, 70 years of that. And it's every time we've come close, it's been when parties have got together and talked rather than killing each other. And that's something that they need to kind of wake up to and say, okay, what happened on October 7 should never happen again. And it was horrific. And what's happened in the last 12 months has been horrific.
Well, it's interesting. Benjamin Netanyahu said there is a way to end what's happening at the moment. There is a way to end the war, and that is for Hamas to release the Israeli hostages and to effectively put its weapons down. And the Jordanian foreign minister at the United Nations General Assembly the week before last said, well, we pledge to Israel on behalf of all Arab nations in the Middle East that you have our full support to exist if you come to the table with a two-state solution, because that is the only way out of the mess that has now been created. But Netanyahu, it doesn't seem like he is willing to compromise on borders or on, on having that sort of two-state solution. The more he doesn't do that, the more Hamas will continue its fight, the more then Israel will continue its assault on Gaza and then sort of, spread out into trying to fight Hezbollah, which obviously backed then by Iran. And to Ozan's point, Rodney, like what is the way through here? What is the end objective that will see us stop discussing this issue on this podcast and stop the killings of thousands and thousands of innocent people?
When people are tired of conflict and loss of life, and it doesn't feel like we've reached that point, when people are making public pronouncements that are setting demands that they know their opponents can't or won't reach, we're not gonna find ourselves in the point where there is dialogue and so on to try and reach some broader political sentiment. I mean, if the hostages are remaining hostages are released today, is that really going to stop any Israeli response against Iran for the rocket barrage that took place recently, or air drone and rocket barrage? The answer is probably not. And when you have loss of life on the scale as what there has been and what there'll continue to be in the coming weeks, because there's going to be Israeli loss of life from the ground offensive in southern Lebanon, and potentially through further trading of military action with Iran and response and counter response. You know, you have this emotional legacy, you have mental health legacy in the region, and you have what you get is sustained generational conflict, which takes an awful long time to move away from. There has to be an appetite for something different and an appetite to compromise in order to move away from the cycle of action and response that we find ourselves in. And you know, if we look at regional dynamic, which is where we started, the relations between Israel and its Gulf Arab neighbors, which were on a huge positive with the Abraham Accords and you know this platform for potential greater regional cooperation. I mean, that's all been put on ice by what's happened in the intervening period through Gaza, through southern Lebanon, and now with Iran, because the political dynamic and game has changed in the region as a result of that. And in order to get back to those types of points of on platforms for diplomacy, it's going to take de-escalation, some form of cooling off period, and some form of dialogue followed by a level of constructive effort. And I can't see that happening in the near term, in the current situation that's playing out.
Look, you also have to look at this from a broader perspective. I think even if Israel and Hamas, Hezbollah wanted to get together onto the and sit down at the table and thrash this out, you have Iran, who, you know, I think that the Jordanians' sentiments are great, but Jordan has absolutely no influence over what Iran does and what it kind of pushes. So as long as Iran is pushing what it has been pushing for the last 10, 15 years, you're not going to have the more localized groupings and more localized adversaries getting together to come up with any solution. So any, as you know, to your point, Adam, that this thing has gotten more complicated because now you have a very active player in Iran that needs to sit down at the table, and that also involves other bigger players like the US, EU, some of Iran's traditional allies, to come together and really try and put together a political response. So the political response is actually, if you ask me, the solution is two-state solution, but before you get there are many steps in terms of ensuring that Iran does its part and does not continue its adversarial stance against Israel. That's going to take a massive diplomatic push. It may, before it gets to a diplomatic push, as we've seen recently, it may have to be through a military action that whether Israel or allies, etc., take to bring Iran to the table. So I think that's an element that, you know, we can't ignore, because at the end of the day, Iran holds a very strong piece of this, and has a major stake in going towards a peaceful solution.
But how much diplomacy power, I guess, does especially the US have in this conflict? Because I ask that because I'm thinking of the interview that Kamala Harris gave to 60 Minutes, where the anchor asked her, well, in Prime Minister Netanyahu, the Prime Minister of Israel, do we have an ally in the region? And she just didn't answer that question. And she said, I think the better question to ask is, you know, do we have an alliance or an ally in the Israeli people, between the Israeli people and the American people? And the answer to that is yes. Well, of course, the answer to that is yes. That's always the answer. But, you know, on a political level, the US and the West just doesn't seem to have the sway. So is the problem then, I mean, the problem is exasperated, but is the issue then, well, there is no diplomatic solution because the West doesn't have the power, the US doesn't have the power to sort of, I guess, come in and be the mediator. And then it becomes back down to, well, then the only way out of this is for the Middle East to solve itself. And as we've discussed, well, it hasn't done that for decades and centuries. The stalemate continues.
Yeah, there's a difference between when you want to facilitate a dialogue where the parties are looking for an off-ramp and where they're not, and the West or the US simply doesn't have the leverage over the various parties to this particular flashpoint to force a conversation. And there's not an appetite within the various parties to have that conversation. That's the external view at the moment. Perhaps there are better noises being made to various potential third parties or intermediaries, but sadly, I suspect not. But even within the 60 minutes interview, you know, Kamala Harris has to answer within the backdrop of an American election. We're being too close to the Israeli position at the current time, where you know, Netanyahu and Israel are within many sections of US society perceived to be going too far. And you know, there's a electoral jeopardy attached to what she says and what she does. Nobody's coming at this from a blank page where they're giving an independent, honest, or objective assessment of the current state and the way forward. All this stuff, even within other regions and so on, is political for them within their own voter bases and populations and so on. Whether that's what she thinks is one thing. It's what she's limited to be able to say.
You're not going to get a clear answer from her until after the election. And who becomes president, I think, makes a very is a very important element in all of this, because it really determines what type of future we see in the Middle East. And you know, it may not look on the surface like Trump has much of a plan for the Middle East. You know, one would not be a kind of or one could be excused for assuming that. But the tension within the politics that's going on in America, in the US, between those who believe in a more kind of globalist slash neocon, you know, old school way of enforcing US power, those who are being challenged by people like Trump, who believe in a more isolationist America first, you know, let's not be the world's police, etc., and really trying to pull the US out of those sorts of arrangements and out of that type of role. This is a tension, and this is a big conflict that's been going on in the US domestically for a long time. So I think that's it playing in the background, and hence, you know, if you're looking to the US for leadership to make a ceasefire or to bring about a two-state solution, etc., I think you're, you know, if you're waiting for that, you're going to be waiting for a while, because the US is not united in its approach to these sorts of problems. You're going to see the same thing with China if those issues start to get more tense. The US foreign policy is a very mixed up, schizophrenic kind of policy right now. On one hand, it's all about trying to impose political power, but it's always kind of held back because domestically, US's traditional stance in the world is domestically and politically quite unpopular. And you know, suppose when you spend 20 years in kind of wars that make no sense, the US population sees that as a waste of time, waste of money, and you know, something that really doesn't help the US. So if you're a leader in the US government, in the foreign or the kind of State Department, you have a lot of political pressure to play this really kind of odd role.
Well, speaking of the US population and of US politics, it was really interesting article that appeared in the Los Angeles Daily News that a friend to this podcast, Matthew Klink, a experienced government affairs and strategic communications consultant in the US, put up on his LinkedIn that I found really interesting. It's some research by the Pew Research Center and Gallup that shows the following: 75% of Democrats believe Republicans are closed-minded. 64% of Republicans believe that Democrats are closed-minded. 63% of Republicans view Democrats as unpatriotic, and 47% of Democrats see Republicans as unpatriotic. Now, it's no surprise that different ends of the political spectrum view each other as completely wrong and, you know, incredibly closed-minded. That's, I think, that doesn't come as a surprise to anybody. But it does show the deadlock nature of where the election in the US is at. Let's start with Trump, Rodney, and him returning to the site of the shooting. over the weekend to hold a rally there, and the appearance of a certain billionaire in the world, Mr. Elon Musk, obviously was there as well. What did you think of Elon coming along and the rally in general, Trump holding a minute's silence at the time that the assassination attempt took place? How did you sort of read the events of the weekend and where Trump is heading now?
I think there's always a distinction between the audience you can garner and the message you deliver. And apart from Musk appearing awkward and, dare I say, weird in terms of his participation in the event with his, this is the last election, if people don't get out and vote, and his reference to dark MAGA, and so on. Yes, he does have a huge platform. Yes, he does have the ability to have people listen. But if what you say doesn't get you any further forward, when you get that opportunity with an audience, it's not that helpful. I'm not sure this helps Trump. I'm not sure this helps Musk. I don't think it helps the credibility of either. And I don't think it's going to improve the electoral outcomes for Trump, this rally that took place on Saturday in particular. Yeah, I mean, there's other stuff that's happening, which is interesting in terms of what they're doing during the course of this week, what the areas of focus on, and also the volume of noise that each campaign's making. Where there's a drop off from Harris and there's a sustained level of noise from Trump, but the noise has to have some form of connection and then impact. And I'm not sure, certainly in relation to this event, that he's achieved that. Maybe Ozan has a different view.
Well, my view is I'm gobsmacked at both of the campaigns. I have no idea what either of them are doing in terms of or what the agenda is here. I mean, I think having Elon Musk at your event, jumping up and down, this, as Rodney said, I completely agree. I don't think this is going to get one extra vote. Elon Musk has gone from a very interesting character, somebody that I think a lot of people had a lot of respect for, to now somebody, being the butt of many people's jokes and memes, etc., on a platform that he bought with the promise to make it a kind of platform and beacon of freedom of speech and impartiality. He's now using that platform to push really, really weird ideas and very, very kind of, if you ask me, unpopular agendas. So I think this guy has lost the credibility of most normal kind of Americans. He is very much loved amongst the kind of MAGA, Joe Rogan, tech bros kind of community. And that, I think, translates very clearly to where Trump is doing really well. I think places like or demographics like, young, non-college educated men, white men mainly, but also black men as well, men of color. It's they're very much targeting a certain audience, but they're not going beyond that. And I honestly don't understand what they're doing. I mean, they have, if you ask me, Vance won a debate last week, and he won that debate. If you look at it from the point of view of how the media or people involved in politics would look at it, he was sharp. He was, very well polished, etc. But at the end of the day, he actually did a lot of damage to himself and this is where my initial comment was around what the Kamala Harris campaign is doing. Vance made a whole bunch of cock-ups in that campaign, debate, that the Harris campaign should be hammering, absolutely hammering. And, they put out an ad around the January 6th response or non-response that Vance gave, which I think was impactful. But, all of the crap that came out of his mouth around the abortion issue, about healthcare, how he was claiming that that Trump somehow saved Obamacare, and it was just you can be smart and you can be intelligent and you can have a very good debate and be absolutely wonderful at debating. And also you can talk absolute bullshit and be full of shit. These two things are not mutually exclusive. And I think Vance is paying for that because many people, despite Waltz's cock-ups himself, Waltz was not a great debater. He didn't do very well on a few questions. But where he screwed up are things that people just don't care about. I mean, who cares when he was in Tiananmen Square? But people do care about Vance trying to be someone that he's not on issues like abortion, which I think was a strategically really stupid thing to do, because if there's one issue that has cemented kind of views that you're not going to change overnight, it's the abortion issue, because the Democrats have done a pretty good job over the last 2 years painting the Republicans as a kind of trying to strip away people's rights. And to go there and put a softened kind of version of that and to try and soften that issue just makes you look completely disingenuous. So I'm confused as to what both of the campaigns are doing. I think Harris should be running really, really hard, and I can't see, I won't say complacency, but they seem to have kind of taken their feet off the gas pedal a little bit. And then Trump is just Trump, and again, we talked last time, there are so many issues that he could be just putting normal messages out there on, and he is in the paid media, but there's so many normal things he can do on so many weaknesses that Kamala Harris and the Democrats have, but he's just refusing to do them. So yeah, I'm in a state of confusion, guys.
Well, you're not the only one, my friend, because the states that will be deciding the election, those toss-up states, you're looking at your Pennsylvanias, North Carolinas, Georgia, Arizona, Wisconsin, Michigan, Nevadas of the US, they are all absolutely tied. There is not a single state where either candidate is in front by more than 1.5 percentage points, which of course means that it is impossible to call those states either way. It is likely to come right down to the wire, and a handful of votes will likely decide which way those states will go in the broader electoral map of the or electoral college rather of the US, which of course ultimately determines who then takes the keys over to the White House. We always speak about an October surprise. It's more likely to probably be more of a November surprise. But final predictions from you, Rodney, in the last less than 30 days heading to the polls for the US.
I mean, if you look at the direction of conversation over August and September for the Democrats, they doubled spending on ads around abortion. The Republicans focus very much on inflation and on housing. It's really too close to call in the swing states. And although I think we've had 4 weeks in a row where there's been more conversation coming from or noise coming from the Trump rather than the Harris camp. If you look at what Harris is due to do this week, CBS, of course, is going to go out today. She's got Tuesday, she's doing The View, and then she's doing Stephen Colbert. And then she has an event in Las Vegas targeted at Latino voters on Thursday before she goes to Arizona on Friday. Trump, interestingly, is with Jewish leaders today in relation to an anniversary around the events of last year, which, of course, is where we started. But given his performance with that particular audience last time, that certainly has areas of hazard around it. But again, on Tuesday, he's also going to Latino leaders with engagement before Michigan on Thursday. So we are seeing both race horses in this particular contest starting to really focus on Latino voters, and I think we'll see a lot more of that as a potential defining demographic of the outcome within the swing states over the next period of time. The Democrats are going to go hard on national debt doubling potentially under Trump and his policies, but they need to explain what that actually means for people because it's an abstract concept. And I see New York Times again today are focusing on age and decline from Trump from previous election campaigns in this one, and I expect that to feature quite strongly. Overall, too close to call. Harris is obviously shading it on the polls, but within those swing states, there's nothing really outside the margin of error. So all to play for. I think we will see some surprises. What they are, I think we're going to look forward to over the coming weeks.
Well, a good place to leave it, not knowing what the future holds, which means more podcast episodes for us. Gentlemen, good chatting to you again this week. See you next.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And that's been this week's episode of Put Simply. Be sure to follow us on LinkedIn at Oroku Group to stay up to date with all the latest episodes and news. Feel free to leave a comment and suggestions on what you'd like to see featured on the podcast as well. Until next time, I'm Erdem Koch.
And I'm Ozan Ibrahim.
Thanks for listening.